from WXXI News. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour is made when we can make connections with each other again. I mean post-pandemic, but I really mean post-vaccination. And so let me ask you at the start of this hour, what is the thing that you want to do most when you're vaccinated? What comes to mind first? Is it hugging a loved one? Is it hosting a dinner party? Is it going to a live concert? Is it going to some kind of an art performance? Outdoors? Indoors? Indoors feels so scandalous these days. Indoors? Did we used to do that? Are we going to do that again? We are. We certainly are eventually. The question of what we want to do and what we're going to be able to do, it's been sort of in conflict with each other, those ideas. And so we've invited Dr. Julia Marcus to join us on the program again. She is an infectious disease epidemiologist and an associate professor at Harvard Medicine. And I've gotten to know Dr. Marcus through her work at The Atlantic, where she has been writing for the duration of this pandemic and writing in a way that I find really gripping, powerful, important. Her newest piece for The Atlantic is titled, "Vaccinated People Are Going to Hug Each Other." She writes, "The vaccines are phenomenal, belaboring their imperfections and telling people who receive them never to let down their guard carries its own risks." And I'm going to quote from her piece. I want to stress something here, and you're going to hear her stress it in our conversation, I'm sure. This is not a case of an epidemiologist saying that we should all let our guards down, that we should stop wearing masks, that we should kind of get out and go have fun however we want, wherever we want, whenever we want. But she is saying that the messaging has been too dark. She writes the following, quote, "When Americans began receiving coronavirus vaccines last month, people started fantasizing about the first thing they do when the pandemic ends, go back to work, visit family, travel, hug friends. But the public discussion soon shifted. One news article after another warned about everything that could go wrong. Protection isn't immediate. Vaccinated people can still transmit the virus. Vaccinated people might get mild infections that could become chronic. Vaccines might not work as well against new variants. COVID-19 vaccine doesn't mean you can party like it's 1999, one headline admonished. Can vaccinated people at least hang out with one another? Nope. Masks and distancing are still required, said another. Bottom line, yet another article concluded ominously, you will need to wear a face mask after you're vaccinated until COVID-19 cases become nearly non-existent," end quote. Advising people that they must do nothing differently after vaccination, not even in the privacy of their homes, creates the misimpression that vaccines offer little benefit at all. And Dr. Marcus writes, quote, "Vaccines provide a true reduction of risk, not a false sense of security. And trying to eliminate even the lowest risk changes in behavior both underestimates people's need to be close to one another and discourages the very thing that will get everyone out of this mess, vaccine uptake," end quote. We're going to work through this piece with her this hour. Again, I want to sort of state my bias here. I think this message from Dr. Marcus is vital. I think we have to feel hope in this moment. I think we must feel and frankly, celebrate the victories that we have while we mourn the losses, because we are finally starting to see the light. We're seeing case reduction in our own community. The numbers are getting better. They're going in a better direction. They're going in a better direction in a lot of parts of the country, and they're going in a much better direction in places with higher rates of vaccination. There's a lot to be hopeful about. That's when I welcome Dr. Julia Marcus back to Connections. Dr. Marcus, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Your message is a strong one here. You write that vaccinated people are going to hug each other, and yet that's almost controversial, even in this country, to say that at this point, even if it seems like an obvious conclusion. Why is it almost controversial to say that vaccinated people are going to hug each other?
I think there is a lot of valid concern right now with the amount of community spread we still see across the U.S. that any change in behavior among vaccinated people could contribute to transmission. But, you know, I did not write that piece to tell people what they should or shouldn't do, but simply to acknowledge that there is a real and substantial reduction in the risk of disease with vaccination. And now we're starting to see data amassing on the reduction in transmission as well. And so, you know, we have to recognize that people will respond to a reduction in risk, and that's not about a false sense of security. It really is a reaction to a true reduction in risk. And you know, at the same time, communicate the uncertainties and the imperfections of vaccines. I think it's a nuanced message, and I think the public can handle nuance.
Yeah, the first good data that we're getting comes from Israel, where they are vaccinating more rapidly than many other countries, and the data is really good. It's really encouraging. We are seeing exactly the number of infections, hospitalizations, and fatalities go in the direction that we hoped. So all of the things that we're hoping seem to be happening. Now, with the caveat that any new variant presents its own complications, I want to talk about what the messaging is and what the messaging still could be. And I want to start in other countries. You write about messaging elsewhere in the world. I'm going to quote from your piece now. Quote, public health experts elsewhere in the world are emphasizing hope. In a new social media campaign, health officials from across the European Union stress that vaccination will help people get their lives back. I'll do it to protect my father and organize a big family weekend get-together, declares Belgium's chief scientific advisor. I did it because I want us to live normally again, says the chief coronavirus advisor in Romania. End quote. Why is it that our messaging is so dour, I guess is the word that comes to mind for me? Why? Especially when you compare to other countries.
I think, you know, there's a lot to say there. Studies have actually looked at media coverage of the pandemic in the U.S. versus other places and have seen that in general, the media coverage of the pandemic in the U.S. has been more negative and emphasized fear much more than in other places, and that those characteristics have not actually correlated with what's going on in the pandemic. It's just been consistent. And so I do think there is something going on there in terms of the media. But then we can also talk about public health messaging. And I do think there's been a real emphasis on the uncertainties around vaccines, not because it's the concern is not that that's an inaccurate message. It's actually it is accurate and important. But I think it has been at the expense of what the most promising things are about these vaccines, what the whole point of them is, and what they will bring us with widespread vaccination. And I think those things need to be emphasized as well. And the EU has really, I think, spoken to what is important to people and what they really want from vaccination. And we all have this shared goal of ending the pandemic, and vaccines, I think, are very likely to get us there. And so I think emphasizing that is what will, communicate appropriately what the whole point of the vaccines is. And also will, I think emphasizing the uncertainties and imperfections also risks dissuading vaccine uptake. And the most important thing right now that we all need to be focused on is getting the highest risk people vaccinated. And I think focusing our energies on whether people are going to have small changes in their behavior after vaccination is a distraction from that shared goal.
Yeah, so there's one aspect that I don't think your piece touched on this, but it came to mind for me, being the son of an attorney. You know, my father's joked forever that we are a litigious society and lawyers are always on the back of people's minds if they're making policy. Is there anything to that? Do you think in the United States, given the litigious nature of this society, there's a fear that if we tell you that you can hug somebody and they somehow get infected, that we could get sued? Or if we tell you that you could go to the movie and there's an infection, we could get sued? Is there any concern about that?
That's an interesting question. I've thought about it more from the perspective of there being this fear that people will abuse their freedom, that if you give people an inch, they'll take a mile, and that people are just waiting for some excuse to act recklessly. And I think, some people might. Some people might act recklessly. With what we know about these vaccines, that is probably going to cause, probably wouldn't even cause that much harm. But of course, we don't want social norms to shift at this point toward everybody partying, right? But I think what's more likely to happen and what survey data are showing is that some people after vaccination may shift their behavior in small ways while understanding that we need to continue to have precautions in public spaces until more people are vaccinated and until infections start to wane. And so, you know, the message is not vaccines will change everything, but it's also not vaccines will change nothing. As usual, there's a lot of nuance and a lot of, middle ground there that I think we need to pay attention to.
Well, I think it was your piece last spring or into the summer in which you referenced some of the messaging looking around the world versus the United States at the time then. And if I'm remembering correctly, Holland, for example, was talking about sexual partners, about intimate partners, about realistic, for people who are single, realistically approaching a pandemic and maybe choosing one intimate partner to try to maintain intimacy during a pandemic. Canada was talking about family double bubbles. The United States was talking about lockdown. And I think you were one of the ones who emphasized, am I remembering correctly, those messages back then?
Yes, yes. Yeah, the sex buddy messaging in the Netherlands and the double bubble messaging in Canada. Yeah, we don't do a great job in the U.S. of recognizing people's human needs and the realities of human behavior. And I think during the pandemic in the U.S., we have really considered social interaction and sexual interaction to be inessential. And you see that in policies that have restricted any interaction outside of one's household. And of course, that's not something that's been in place across the U.S. at all times, but we have seen those policies. And then in the Netherlands, that sex buddy recommendation was really a response to the public saying, look, single people cannot have no physical interaction for an extended period of time, and that's not a fair policy. And so the government said, you're right, and actually sex is a part of a healthy life. And so we are going to make this recommendation about how you can go about getting that need met in a way that's as safe as possible.
Yeah, the term sex buddy that you're using there, just to be clear for listeners, that was the term that the government used, right?
That's right.
Yeah. And when it comes to that kind of messaging in the United States, can you even imagine that term being used by public officials in this country?
It is hard to imagine, but we do see some policies and guidance coming out of local health departments that reflects that kind of harm reduction oriented approach. We've seen it coming out of New York, and that has been adopted in San Francisco and Los Angeles, specifically around sexual interaction during the pandemic. So there are examples that I think are much more progressive. They just don't tend to come at a national level as much here. And especially with the prior administration, I think there was a lot that the CDC could not say or do that they normally would have. And so some of this really is about the political climate. And, but I do think there is a kind of history of Puritanism here. And we see that in general in resistance to harm reduction policies for substance use. For sex work, there's a lot of regressive policies in the U.S. that we don't see in other countries like Canada and the Netherlands quite as much.
In a moment, I want to talk a little bit about the AIDS epidemic and pandemic and what we've learned in those ways, because there are some parallels, and I know you've done a lot of work on that. But before I get there, listeners, we're talking to Dr. Julia Marcus, infectious disease epidemiologist and associate professor at Harvard Medicine. And she's the author of a number of pieces on different platforms, including The Atlantic, pieces that I think have been a real guiding light for understanding how we communicate with one another during this pandemic. And the latest that caught my eye was titled Vaccinated People Are Going to Hug Each Other. The vaccines, she writes, are phenomenal, and belaboring their imperfections and telling people who receive them never to let down their guard carries its own risks. So when we think about, some of the messaging, you mentioned that, especially in the last administration, there were some limitations. Are you seeing changes already with the new administration?
I have a lot of hope with this change in administration that the CDC in particular is going to be restored to its usual trustworthy, self. And of course, there are limitations at the CDC in general. It's often slow and bureaucratic, but the CDC is full of brilliant, hardworking scientists, epidemiologists, physicians, and is really full of expertise on public health messaging and policy. And I think the political interference in what the CDC was doing has had an enormous impact during the pandemic on science communication and on science policy. So I do have hope now that, particularly with Dr. Rochelle Walensky, who I know personally in the lead at the CDC, that we're really going to see that institution restored with great benefits for everyone.
Dr. Monica Gandhi out of University of California, San Francisco, wrote recently that two vaccinated people can be as close as two spoons in a drawer. Is that a better message in your mind?
My approach is not to tell people what they can or should do or can't or shouldn't do, but to give people the information that they need to make informed decisions. And of course, sometimes in public health, we really do have to make strong recommendations and put even restrict movement and restrict public spaces. But I think in this case, it makes sense to tell people what the reality is, which is that if you have two people in a room and one of them is vaccinated, that's safer than neither of them being vaccinated. And if both are vaccinated, that's even safer. And then also thinking about which one is vaccinated. Is it the person who is particularly vulnerable to a bad outcome? Then you've really reduced the risk of something bad happening in that interaction. So I think we need to give people that information and understand and trust that people will act accordingly.
Yeah, I'm sure since your piece came out, you've had people asking you, can I do this? Can I do that? And I take the point that you are not in the business of telling people what they should or should not do. It's more, I think, about understanding basic human behavior, history, a little bit of the psychology of this. In my own case, I will be honest with listeners, and I will say that I made the decision over the holidays just not to travel. My aging parents in Cleveland wanted to see me, but they understood entirely. And I was very nervous. I mean, they are in the high risk category for a number of reasons about health history and age. And I'm very, very worried about them. And so hard as it was a quiet Christmas. It was a quiet New Year's. And I haven't seen my parents since Christmas 2019. And so what we've talked about recently, Dr. Marcus, is so my mother got her first vaccine shot about a week ago, my stepfather about a week ago, my father about 2 weeks ago. And they're saying to me, look, once we have two vaccines in our arms, once we get both doses and two more weeks have passed, you ought to come home and do Christmas then, whether you're vaccinated or not. I don't know if I'm going to. I'll be honest with listeners. We're working on that. It sounds pretty good to me, especially if I'm not interacting with a whole lot of other people. If it's just myself, maybe my son, my mom, she's vaccinated, but I don't know. I guess the question for you is, are you hearing from people like me going, can I do this? And do you generally say, don't ask me?
I've been hearing those questions for months and months, both from, friends and family, but also from people who just, strangers who read my pieces and are trying to make personal decisions in their lives. And I always evade the question, but I try to, again, go back to a risk framework where instead of telling people what they should do, giving them a sense of what the relative safety is and what the relative risk is. And so for your situation, the risk to your parents of a bad outcome based on the data we have on vaccines right now, and if we define a bad outcome as hospitalization or death, we are seeing none of that happening in people who have been vaccinated in clinical trials. We are seeing no hospitalizations or deaths. And so, of course, things can change. There are variants emerging, but even in the context of the variants that are out there right now, we are still seeing no hospitalizations or deaths in people who have been vaccinated. And so, it's up to you and your parents what to do with that information. But for me, that's the information I would want to provide to you.
Yeah, I was listening to Zeynep Tufekci with Ezra Klein on his podcast just this morning. And Zeynep was making the point that you just made and emphasizing that even in one of the, I don't know if it was Pfizer or Moderna, but they had a total of one person with severe infection who had been vaccinated, not a placebo infection, but an actual vaccine and then severe infection. And that was a case of a woman whose blood oxygen got down to 93. Had it stayed at 94, it would have been categorized as mild. So, I mean, she's not saying it was, well, I think she quoted a doctor saying it was close to a nothing burger, though technically severe. That was the one out of now tens of thousands, and we're seeing hundreds of thousands. So that's some of the data we have. But then what about this argument that we keep hearing that you emphasized in your piece that kind of keeps getting repeated, which sounds something like this. Hey, what we really need is data. We don't need speculation. We don't need hope. We need data. And until we have data, we should all just wait. What do you say to that?
I mean, I would say, first of all, that we do have data. We have quite a lot of data from a number of clinical trials. We now have data from real-world vaccine distribution, particularly in Israel. And the data tell us that there is a vast reduction in risk of disease, and particularly severe disease and death for people who are vaccinated compared to people who are not. And also, we are now seeing data showing that vaccines will reduce transmission to some extent. But we know that they are not going to eliminate transmission. So we have to take that into consideration as well. And I would say that we do need to maintain, I'll say again, actually, that we do need to maintain precautions in public settings. And the reason I say that is that vaccine status, immunity, vulnerability, none of those are things that are easily identifiable in public. And so we can't have a kind of immunity passport situation where certain people can access certain services or, you know, can take their masks off if they've been vaccinated. I think that would be a mess for a lot of reasons. But not every interaction happens in public settings. And so I think we need to arm people with the information that we have from the data that we have and allow it to be updated as we are accumulating data in real time.
Going to squeeze in a little bit more with Dr. Julia Marcus, infectious disease epidemiologist and associate professor at Harvard Medicine. So when you mention uptake, it strikes me that what you're really kind of talking about is kind of a backfire effect. And so I'll read from your piece again. I just want to make sure we put a point on this. You write, quote, advising people that they must do nothing differently after vaccination, not even in the privacy of their homes, creates the misimpression that vaccines offer little benefit at all. Vaccines provide a true reduction of risk, not a false sense of security. And trying to eliminate even the lowest risk changes in behavior both underestimates people's need to be close to one another and discourages the very thing that will get everyone out of this mess, vaccine uptake, end quote. You're really worried that we could see at least some impact on the overall population of people who are willing to get vaccinated.
I mean, this is something that I am seeing from people all the time right now, is particularly people for whom the risk of a bad outcome personally is low from infection. For them, the risk-benefit equation around getting a vaccine may be a bit different from somebody like your parents who are older and really at high risk of a bad outcome. In that case, it may be very obvious to them that the benefits of a vaccine outweigh the risks of a vaccine. But for somebody who is already, you know, skeptical about vaccines, concerned about the risk of vaccines, even though we know that those risks are extremely low for these vaccines. A younger person may say, why should I get this vaccine and take any risk at all if it's going to change nothing for me, if it really doesn't reduce risk in a meaningful way such that I can change my behavior at all? And so, you know, I'm not saying that we should craft our messaging to promote vaccine uptake, but simply we should be aware that when we overemphasize the limitations of vaccines, without giving due attention to the ways that they really do provide a massive reduction in risk, we may dissuade some people from getting vaccinated, which is really counterproductive.
Yeah, and I will say for myself, this is not looking for Dr. Marcus's approval. This is just from my own perspective. When I'm vaccinated, whenever that is, fully vaccinated, and friends of mine are fully vaccinated, we are having dinner at home. That not out, you know, not a big party. We're not going clubbing, but that will be on the agenda for me, and I will feel good about that based on the evidence, and I look forward to that. And so I want to read from you what David Lenhart wrote in the New York Times. He wrote a piece about underselling the vaccine, and he put together what he thinks a proper public message might sound like given the many experts in the field that he has spoken to. Here's what he writes, quote, we should immediately be more aggressive about mask wearing and social distancing because of the new virus variants. We should vaccinate people as rapidly as possible, which will require approving other COVID vaccines when the data justifies it. People who have received both of their vaccine shots and have waited until they take effect will be able to do things that unvaccinated people cannot, like having meals together and hugging their loved ones. But until the pandemic is defeated, all Americans should wear masks in public, help unvaccinated people stay safe, and contribute to a shared national project of saving every possible life, end quote. How do you like David Lenhart's message?
I love his message. I think it's perfect.
Wow, that's a hell of an endorsement. So I just want to talk a little bit about what we have learned from AIDS. You wrote about in your piece about anxiety, about how people might behave when they are less afraid, you know, this idea that, well, you know, if you give people too much confidence, they'll do something we don't want them to do. Tell me what we learned about what we've learned from AIDS, HIV, PrEP, and more here? What are the lessons that you see?
I'm an HIV prevention researcher. My focus is on trying to figure out how we can better implement pre-exposure prophylaxis, or PrEP, for HIV. And this is a daily pill you can take to prevent HIV, kind of like birth control to prevent unwanted pregnancy. And one of the major discussions around PrEP, especially when it was first coming up for FDA approval in 2012, was this concern that people would increase their risk behavior if they were taking PrEP. So they would take PrEP, they would feel protected from HIV, they'd have less fear, and so they'd use condoms less. And this was really, I can't overemphasize how much this dominated the discussion about PrEP. So instead of this, new, amazing, highly effective prevention tool being seen as a total revolution in HIV prevention and having the capacity to end the HIV epidemic, the focus was really on this is going to cause sexual anarchy and people are going to be promiscuous and stop using condoms. And it really was a distraction. And I think contributed to a lot of hesitation around prescribing, and still does. There really is, there continues to be this stigma around condomless sex, even among people taking PrEP, that has been a barrier to PrEP uptake. And we still only see about 1 in 5 people who could benefit from PrEP taking it. And there are many other barriers too, but I think this discussion has really gotten in the way. And I started to see the discussion around COVID vaccines going in the same direction. And it really raised a red flag for me. And so I wanted to point to this other, kind of prevention transition for a different virus that that did not go well for some of these because of some of these concerns around behavior change.
Yeah. But what do you say to those who have made the argument, especially about HIV, just to take HIV as an example? Look, if you want to be truly safe, abstain. Abstinence is your best path here. They would argue, some would argue, that that's correct, that that's true, that that is accurate information. Stop having sex and you can protect yourself. Generally, how do you feel about that?
I mean, I think we should always communicate what the safest option is. And if you want to eliminate risk of HIV transmission, not having sex is a great way to do that. And similarly with the coronavirus, if you want to eliminate risk of transmission, don't interact with other human beings. But both of those are difficult sells, and both of those, for many people, will sacrifice other aspects of their health. And so we can't just stop with that message. We have to also give people a sense of relative risk and say, okay, well, the next safest thing you can do is, in the case of HIV, have sex while taking PrEP, have sex with a condom. Here are some other prevention options that will allow you to do the thing you want to do, which for many people is have sex, but do it in a way that's safer, that keeps your risk low. And I think that's the kind of messaging we need around COVID as well. People cannot eliminate interaction with other human beings, either because of work or because of social needs. And so we have to give people a sense of how they can conduct their lives in a way that is safer, but not necessarily 100% safe.
Can I ask you to give us a word on your thoughts about shaming, whether it's about shaming people to wear masks in public, shaming people for going out to eat, shaming people for visiting loved ones on Christmas? I mean, how do you feel about shaming?
I generally think that what we've learned from HIV and other areas of public health is that shaming is not an effective public health strategy. And when I say shaming, I mean basically telling people that they're bad people for making certain choices around risk. And this is not to say that we should condone risk-taking or ignore it, but just to say that when we tell people they are being selfish and reckless and that risk-taking is a sign of bad character, what we're doing is we're driving them away from public health efforts. We're contributing to stigma. We're making it less likely that people will disclose their behaviors to us and less likely that they will disclose to other people that they may have exposed them, that they have symptoms, and engage, less likely that they'll engage in contact tracing. And so, and now, even today, decades into the HIV epidemic, stigma continues to be a major barrier worldwide to ending HIV. So I think we need to think about other tactics, which include compassionate messaging that recognizes why people are taking risks. Usually when we take a step back and we say, why is risk taking happening? We can end up with an answer that will help guide better messaging and better policies and actually help us problem solve. If the answer is that somebody is taking risks, let's say going to work sick because they need a paycheck, that gives us a solution. Like, we need to make sure that people can afford to stay home. If the answer is that people are having a party because they need social connection, give them a safer place to gather socially. Set up an open-air tent in a town green with fire pits. So this is a way that we can guide ourselves toward more empathetic messaging and policies that avoid shame and perpetuation of stigma.
Two more quick questions, and we got to run here. When we think about a vulnerable population, especially in nursing homes where there's been a remarkably high number of deaths and infections from COVID, how important do you think the message is that the vaccine can lead you out of whatever darkness you may be feeling in isolation? The vaccine can allow you to see your family as opposed to get vaccinated but still wait. I mean, I'm thinking especially of nursing homes, especially if people have been hurting and scared and isolated. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I mean, I think there are certain segments of society that have been particularly affected by isolation, by social isolation. And I think nursing homes are really a stark example of that. And I'll also point to single people who, you know, in any policy that is about, you know, not interacting outside of your household or single people are kind of forgotten. But for nursing homes, we really do see deterioration in health with social isolation. And I think vaccines and widespread vaccination of both people living in nursing homes and staff can hopefully allow for some evolution in, policies around family members visiting and provide some hope for those settings that we can address those other aspects of health.
Last question for you is on the impact in public trust. And there's a lot of things that impact public trust. One of them is the idea that this process of who gets the vaccine will be equitable and it will be fair. And the AP, the Associated Press, talked to Dolly Parton today. And I love this quote from Dolly Parton. She says, she was asked, "Have you gotten your shot?" She says, "No, I'm not going to get mine until some more people get theirs. I don't want to look like I'm jumping the line just because I donate money." So she is not vaccinated and says, just because I'm a donor and she donated a lot and helped Moderna get off the ground, she says that should not jump me in the line. Meanwhile, we looked into the question of donor preference and unfortunately happened in Rochester at the University of Rochester Medical Center. 26 donors had basically been given a special invite to get vaccinated here. The University of Rochester Medical Center has apologized. They said people shouldn't be given preferential status for that. You could argue these are small cases, a couple dozen donors here at a time. Seattle's seen it. Miami's seen it. New Jersey's seen it. Are you worried about eroding public trust when people see stuff like that?
Absolutely. And I mean, I think it's a much bigger problem even than that. It's, there are situations you're describing where donors may be favored over others. But in general, I think our whole vaccine rollout is favoring people with privilege and people who have the capacity to seek out a vaccine, as opposed to bringing the vaccine to people who are most in need. And this is not just going to hurt the people who are most marginalized and hardest hit by the pandemic. It is going to hurt everyone. You actually need vaccine equity to have population impact. And going back to HIV, this is exactly what we see with the rollout of pre-exposure prophylaxis for HIV infection, where we see limited population impact almost a decade after it was approved by the FDA, simply because people, not only are people not taking it, you know, overall, it's their sort of slow uptake, but also the people who need it most are the people who are least likely to be taking it. And so I think sometimes we think about equity in health as fairness, but it's much more than fairness. The fairness aspect is important and it's crucial, actually, but also it, equity is necessary for impact. And I think that we're seeing now with these huge disparities in who's accessing the vaccine that we are going to have a slower road to population impact because of the way vaccines are being distributed.
Let me stress again my gratitude for your work, Dr. Marcus. Thank you for making the time for the program. We look forward to more from you because there's a long road ahead of us still. But thank you for sort of the guiding light that you've been helping us see what we need to see, or at least understand human behavior a little bit better. It is greatly appreciated.
Thank you so much.
That's Dr. Julia Marcus, infectious disease epidemiologist and associate professor at Harvard Medicine. Want to read an email from a listener named Nathan who sends this along and says, "Wait, so if I'm vaccinated and my relatives are vaccinated, we cannot get together at home? They don't live with me, but if every person who gathers in the home is vaccinated, what is the risk? This makes no sense to me, and I've complied with everything we've been asked to do so we can make it to vaccination. I feel like we are having yet more changes to the goal lines." That's from Nathan. Nathan, again, to be clear here, I think what Dr. Marcus is saying is that some of the public messaging has been emphasizing the unknowns and the risks instead of celebrating the knowns and the successes of the vaccine. And so you might be led to believe that even though you've done everything right and that you and whoever would gather from different households would be fully vaccinated, that there's still a risk. Well, what Dr. Marcus is saying is she's not going to tell you what to do. That's up to you. But yeah, the evidence says that it would be an extraordinary event if you did what you're describing, Nathan, and someone ended up even hospitalized with COVID. Because we have seen literally one case of someone hospitalized from COVID after they were fully vaccinated in the trials and now in the rollouts. Doesn't mean we won't see a handful here and there. We're talking about big, big numbers here, and there are always statistical outliers. So no one can give you any guarantee. No one can guarantee that when you drive a car, your seatbelt won't malfunction. There's a lot of things that can happen. But I'm with you, Nathan. When I've got a vaccine in me, I'm having dinner. That's going to happen. And I think people need to be able to look forward to those kinds of things. And I think that's where Dr. Marcus is. She's not going to tell you what to look forward to. That's up to you. But she's saying that's not unreasonable at all. And that hope is a good thing. Let's take our only break of the hour and come right back on Connections. Coming up in our second hour, a conversation about what happened last Friday when Rochester police officers pepper sprayed a 9-year-old girl. It's a story that has gotten national, even international attention. And now, where do we go next? How do we understand what happened and why? What does it say about our community? What can change? That's next hour. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. So I do want to offer a different perspective on all of this. We've been talking about vaccination and what we're looking forward to after vaccination, how our lives might be changed by it. Dr. Julia Marcus from Harvard joined us earlier in the hour. She wrote a piece for The Atlantic highlighting how in other countries, some of the leading public health faces are doing public information campaigns, and they're all talking about what are you looking forward to most? You want to travel? Do you want to see family? Do you want to get your life back? In this country, it's a different message. It's get vaccinated, but we still don't know. Don't change anything yet. And there are those who think that is the right message right now. Dr. Marcus does not, but there are some who do. And I had a conversation recently with a couple of folks with plenty more expertise than me who are still very, very cautious and want us to really, really sort of hold back as long as we can because we need more data. And frankly, we just need more time to get more people vaccinated. And so you're going to hear their perspective now. This is Dr. Emil Lesho, who is an infectious disease and internal medicine specialist at Rochester Regional Health, and Dr. Renwa Dumiati, who is a professor in infectious diseases in the Department of Medicine and the Center for Community Health and Prevention at the University of Rochester Medical Center.
In short, no, I don't fully agree with what they're saying. One thing I need to keep, you made a very compelling argument in your introduction there as to why we might be able to feel comfortable about relaxing the recommendations of social distancing. But I think we have to keep in mind the levels of strength of evidence, what we look to in medical practice. And what you've all cited was expert opinion. So all those physicians and experts that you had cited were giving their expert opinion. And, I fully acknowledge they are more expert than I am in this, but expert opinion is the lowest level of medical evidence, right? So there, and as you also pointed out, there is a lack of data. So the highest level of strength of evidence would be, numerous randomized controlled trials. And we just don't have that yet. So I'd be very cautious about this. So the number one reason to continue with precautions is to protect yourself. But I also would add to that, it's also to protect others.
Absolutely. I mean, I don't think anybody disagrees that we're nowhere close to the end of masking, unfortunately, and I don't want to wear a mask anymore. Or physical distancing. I think it's a question of if you're in a family member. So Dr. Lesho, if you have your two shots and you've got a family member who has had the two shots and time has passed, Are you comfortable being around them if they're not in the same household? Are you comfortable being around them indoors without masks right now? I'm not talking about going out in public and being in large groups. I'm talking about just you and a friend or you and a family member who's not in the same household who've both been vaccinated now.
No, I experience that situation every day with my colleagues at work. Many of us have received both of our vaccine shots, some of us more than 2 or 3 weeks ago. Yet we still mask. We still share, if we're in office spaces and stuff, both of the parties who have been fully vaccinated still mask.
Okay, Dr. Dumiani, can you give me your thoughts about sort of the public messaging and what the public ought to be thinking about with these vaccines?
Yeah, I agree with Dr. Leschow as well. And what is really missing from this is what we really need is a large number of people vaccinated around us to let our guard down. We also need to, make sure that the number of cases in the community where you live is also lower. So you have to take all these things into consideration and to decide, when should vaccinated people let their guard down and stop masking. I think there is a messaging issue because we're careful because we don't have all the data yet. So we want to make sure that we do everything possible to prevent, you from getting sick or transmitting to others until we get more data. And we're very hopeful that with these vaccines that are very effective, that with time, the number of cases will go down and the number of vaccinated people will go up and one day we'll go back to normal. But right now, we just have to keep doing what we're doing because we have a very, very few number of people vaccinated so far.
All right. That's Renwa Dumiati, Dr. Dumiati, a professor of infectious diseases at the University of Rochester, and Dr. Emil Leschow, an infectious disease and internal medicine specialist at Rochester Regional Health. And I just want to make sure that something is clear. Dr. Leschow talked about wanting more data on physical distancing, social distancing, whatever term you prefer. Certainly, there is no argument that distancing has to continue in public spaces, and probably for a while, because we need to see widespread vaccination before we stop wearing masks in public, before we stop distancing. As Dr. Marcus said earlier in the hour, you can't tell when you bump into somebody in public if they've been vaccinated or not. You can't tell if they've had COVID and convalesced or not. So, and we're probably not going to do that where we identify and wearing a vaccinated hat. I don't think that we're going in that direction. So given that, until we see widespread community adoption, we're probably not going to change. The question really is in those home settings. And Dr. Leschow said that for him, he's still not there. He's still not at a point where even in a home setting, if he's vaccinated and friends from another household are vaccinated, they come over, he said they're still masking. And, I certainly respect that. I also respect people who say that I'm going to take the data we have, which is zero deaths and one out of hundreds of thousands and what will be millions of vaccines administered, one hospitalization, and say that's an incredible success rate. That's what vaccines are all about. And I've got my dinner parties back. I will respect that as well. That's probably the category I'm in. But we're all sort of trying to take the data and make the decisions that are best for us. As time goes on, I want to mention some other news with vaccines because all of the vaccine availability now is Pfizer and Moderna, and all of the frustration that people feel in regards to trying to get appointments for themselves or family members is because we've got a real tight supply. The Biden administration has increased some of the supply. New York State all states get a 5% bump coming up here. But what we're looking for is a sort of a flood, not a drip, 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 but a flood. Well, it looks like we're pretty close on Johnson & Johnson. And let me read the story out of Portland. Professors at Portland State University say that Johnson & Johnson will likely apply for emergency use authorization for its COVID-19 vaccine within the next 2 weeks. And experts in epidemiology there, joining their colleagues elsewhere, saying that this is a successful vaccine, that the data backs it up, and that there is one part of this that's confusing. So let's talk about that. The part that's confusing with the Johnson & Johnson vaccine is that it's considered 66% effective. But that is not really a helpful stat because it's more nuanced than that. You might hear it's 66% effective and think, well, I got a 1 in 3 chance of getting COVID. I don't want to get COVID. It is essentially 100% effective in preventing severe COVID and hospitalization. No deaths, no hospitalizations, no severe cases. So if that's what you're looking for in a vaccine, the J&J vaccine is 100%. Now, 1 in 3 could have mild cases. That's really good. That's better than most flu vaccines. That is a number we would have all taken and run with throughout most of the last year when, number one, we thought vaccines would take 12 to 18 months. Instead, they took 9 to 12. And the feeling was, hey, the flu vaccines, it's a hard one. That's a moving target. There's mutations. Some years of flu vaccines, less than 50%. You know, if you get 50%, if you get 60% with a COVID vaccine, great. The problem is Pfizer and Moderna have spoiled us. You get 95%, and everybody else who comes in at 66 or 70% looks like a dud. It's not a dud. Johnson & Johnson, 66% effective against all cases of COVID, 100%. The experts at Portland State, the experts in epidemiology elsewhere, stressing the number is 100% preventing severe disease and hospitalization. That's really, really good. Now, AstraZeneca, we're seeing different data in a couple different places. The best I'm reading today is that they need a little bit more peer review. But AstraZeneca, you know, looks like its numbers are also not going to be 95%. It's not going to be Pfizer and Moderna, but it's going to be a successful and effective vaccine. And some of the new vaccines, I call them new vaccines. They're not Pfizer and Moderna. So some of the next vaccines are one-shotters, which will only make it easier to get widespread adoption. I mean, if I get Pfizer or Moderna, better believe I'm coming back for dose number two, but there inevitably will be people who don't. So one-shotters are even more effective. So we're looking at a few weeks out, probably, of seeing a big river, you know, sort of vaccines and not just this drip, drip, drip. So the frustration that so many people feel is going to start to wane when that happens. Some of the other frustration in the debate in this state centers around who's eligible. And just reading from the New York Times, there was a lot of pressure from New York City and Mayor Bill de Blasio to open up vaccine eligibility to allow vaccination for restaurant workers, taxi drivers, and drivers of 4 hire vehicles, and workers and residents at facilities for people with developmental disabilities. Governor Cuomo widened the state's eligibility requirements to include those groups on Tuesday after the federal government said it would increase the supply of vaccine doses available to state and local governments. So what the governor is saying is, look, you've been asking, and we're going to say yes now because we're going to start getting more vaccines. We're going to get more Moderna and Pfizer, and we're on the doorstep of seeing more. So yes, restaurant workers, yes, taxi drivers, yes, staff in residential homes for people with developmental disabilities. The restaurant worker piece has been sort of controversial, and I understand that, but also consider that restaurants are hanging on the edge here, and they have not had that federal backstop. The Biden administration and the new Congress is working on wrapping up some parts of aid. The president said, President Biden recently said he's not going to get into office and break a promise on a $2,000 or a $1,400 additional benefit to most Americans. So that's at the top of his mind. But it's not a backstop for restaurants. It's not a bailout for restaurants and bars. And absent that, I at least certainly can understand lobbying to say, hey, let our workers get vaccinated. We want to do more to tell the public we're a place that you can feel good about being, because we're on the edge of the cliff here. So that's where we are with vaccines, and I hope this hour has been illuminating. Once again, our thanks to Dr. Julia Marcus, an infectious disease epidemiologist and a professor at Harvard Medicine. Dr. Renoir Dumiati and Dr. Amalesho joined us last month, and I thought their perspective was important on this as well. And we've got a lot more to come with Connections. Stay right here on member-supported public radio.